Thank you very much, Alec, and to you and David and others for organizing this event at this wonderful school. This is the best time in history to be alive. It's certainly the best time to be a young student at a school like this. All of our chances, but particularly your chances, of living long, healthy lives are greater than ever in history. But it's not only the best time to be born privileged, it's also the best time to be born poor. The chances of escaping poverty are greater than ever in history. It's a time of extraordinary transformation. I think about it as the new Renaissance. And like the Renaissance, a period of hyperspeed innovation, a period where things will happen which were unimaginable to us, let alone our parents and grandparents. And these changes will be more widely shared than ever, any changes ever in history. And that's because this isn't only about vertical leaps of change, it's also about the horizontal spreading around the world. Since the Berlin Wall came down 24 years ago, the world has changed fundamentally. Walls have come down everywhere. Windows are opened. The fresh breeze of change is moving across the world, and this is leading to the extraordinary political changes, the rights being established, and of course the economic changes around the world. Before the Berlin Wall came around, there was only one country in the world that really was totally isolated, but so many others were separated. Their ideas, the ideas that people had, were not shared widely. Indeed, about 60% of the world's population was fragmented away from the ideas that you and I could share. They did not have the opportunities, they did not have the information, and they could not be part of technological or scientific innovation. And now it's only North Korea. It was the most isolated then, it remains the most isolated now, but everyone else basically has access to the same sorts of information as we have, if they have the education, if they have the infrastructure, and if their governments allow them. But this is most countries. 84 countries have become democratic since the Berlin Wall came down. China has opened up. The students at Tsinghua University have basically the same information sets as you do. And so this extraordinary coming together releases genius. It releases genius not only because I believe in a random distribution of genius, and that means there are just a lot more talented people out there accessing ideas and contributing, but also because I believe in ideas of collective genius. We all have fragments of capability in us. We all have the capability to change the world. And when we come together, and when we share ideas, and when we form teams, and particularly diverse teams, ideas leapfrog. And that's why we are living in the period of the most rapid innovation in the history of humanity, and that is likely to continue for at least the next 20 years. There's a big debate about innovation. There are some who believe that actually innovation is slowing down. And they point to facts, like the fact that it takes longer to fly across the Atlantic now than it did when Concorde was there. Or that pharmaceutical invention is slowing down, as evidence that innovation is slowing down. But this is a fragment of the full picture. Because while it might be the case that it does indeed take longer to fly, and it even takes longer for me to get to, from Oxford to here than it did when I was a student, the trains go slower. More and more people are sharing in this. And that in itself is innovation. It's the spreading of ideas. 7 billion people in the world, more people indeed have mobile phones than any other technology. There's many mobile phones as there are people. And with this, many other spreads, spread of vaccines, spread of basic ideas like washing your hands keeps off disease, and spread of big ideas like how to solve the problems of cancer, how to discover a way to get to Mars. These are big ideas. And through collaborative efforts, they are being solved. We will see these changes. So for many of you, like Alec, 17 years old, be 104, I guess, when 2100 comes along. What world will that be? Well, firstly, has a very high probability of living to see that. and has a very high probability of living to see that without the things that might afflict me, like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and dementia. Because there are still some really bad barriers. We'll be able to increase physical life by at least 2 years a decade over the coming decades. It's already leaped on average by 20 years since the 1980s, and that's because of the spreading of knowledge. Average life expectancy in the world now is 20 years higher than it was in the 1980s. And that's just the spreading of information and the creation of new technologies. But it'll be even faster, and we would have solved problems like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, dementia. So you can look forward to be able to reflect on today and think about predictions or ideas that were talked about almost 60 years before. It's impossible to imagine what that world will be. But I'm extremely optimistic that it will be one which is a world much better. But we have to make sure that happens. We cannot take that for granted. It's impossible to assume it, because if we assume it, it won't happen. And what are the things I worry about? I worry about the sources of our progress are also the sources of our destruction. And there are two things in this that we need to think about. The one is that hyperconnectivity, which is the source of all this strength, the integration of the world, globalization, has been both a liberator, both a source of the greatest economic progress and technical progress the world has ever known, but also the source of the super spreading of bad things, of risks, systemic risks, cascading risks. And what we saw in the financial crisis was the first clear evidence of this. The evidence that what happens in a small place, in this case the subprime market in the US, can ripple around the world. And so I imagine the investments of the school were affected, and all of us. 100 million people in the world put out of a job because of something that happened in that particular market. So it's the super spreading of the bads. And that crisis originated as well in technological change. In this case, the creation of instruments, credit derivatives and others, which were not understood by the regulators. And I was one of those. One of a group of about 20,000 people with PhDs from the best institutions, with the best data, the most joined up knowledge, whose job it was to guarantee global financial stability. And when you read the evidence to the congressional other committees about why they let Lehman go almost 6 years ago exactly, the answer is we did not understand. We did not understand how the world had evolved. We did not understand what these complex instruments were being used for. We didn't understand the data. Finance has amazing amounts of data, but we did not know how to drink from the fire hydrant. We did not know how to distill the information and make sense of it. And we also thought that the removal of regulation was the source of strength going forward. It would be a dynamic factor for our economies. We didn't realize that we were basically pulling the rug away from stability. But regulation, if it had continued like it was, might not have solved the crisis either, because the regulators were simply unfit for 21st century purpose, and in many respects remain so. So we need to learn from the financial crisis. We need to learn that the super spreading of bads and the resulting unintended consequences from technological change can be deeply destabilizing. We could see this in other areas, in cyber, which is the nervous system of our communities, of everything. Can you imagine your lives without the cyber world, without the internet? It's very difficult to imagine it now. But this is a very, very fragile, increasingly complex system. So we understand complexity and this hyper-integration that comes out of globalization with the pace of change behind it. And we need to understand that cause and effect, attribution, are becoming more and more difficult because the system is so hyper-connected and complex. And when societies see this, the political response is often counterproductive. We see a pandemic coming. And of course, that is another example of where hyperconnectivity and density affect the outcome. There are 2 billion more people on the planet than there were when the Berlin Wall came down. And that's the result of success. That's the result of improvements in health, in economic opportunity, life expectancy, the decline in infant mortality, and all the other drivers of population growth. It's good news. More density, more urbanization, more people, more connected. But when we modeled the spread of the swine flu from Mexico City around the world, it exactly mirrored airline traffic. The vectors of our connectivity are also the vectors of risk. We open our doors, wonderful things come through, but bad things too. Pandemics, cyber attacks, financial crises, terrorists, whatever. And when societies feel this, the danger is that they want to slam the doors closed. Close the blinds, put back up, and rebuild the walls. And that is a great danger. Cutting off integration, protectionism, nationalism, xenophobia. We blame the other. We blame the foreigners. We blame them over there. They the cause of the problem. And migration, of course, is the biggest driver of progressive change the world has ever known. It's also the reason why all of us are here. None of us would be here if our grandparents or great-grandparents or ancestors in times gone by had not escaped famine, disease, conflict, and other sources of destabilization by moving. They found opportunity in the US. That's why this school is here, because of migrants. America would not exist in the way we know it now with that. And mass movements of people, a third of Ireland migrating, a third of Sweden, a third of Italy. And so when we see the tragedies arriving on the shores of Lampedusa at the moment, and we think this is somehow different to what went on then, we are wrong. It's just that now there are countries with borders in ways that were not there before. No passports existed before about 100 years ago. People moved. And that is the source of dynamism, and we see it in the evidence in Silicon Valley in the US today. Half the patents in the US today. Virtually all the iconic firms that we can think of in Silicon Valley. Well over half the startups in Silicon Valley. Many of the most recent batch of Nobel Prize winners, as always, Academy Award winners, migrants. This is not an accident. These are the innovators. These are the drivers of dynamism in society. But in the UK and elsewhere, we see a desire to shut it out, to close down, to retreat from globalization. UKIP, the Independence Party, getting 24% of the vote in the recent election. And so we need to think about how we manage this integration without withdrawing. Of course we want to hold our politicians accountable. We want to look at them in the eyeball. We want to know who they are. We don't want them somewhere far away like Brussels or Washington or the UN. We want accountability. But you don't need people in your room or in your neighborhood for that. We could have webcams in the European Parliament that tell us when our MEPs are sleeping. We don't need this immediacy. We need to use the technologies to ensure accountability. So one big question is how we manage hyperintegration and openness and whether we are able to stop this reverting to more closed societies, which would be terribly destructive and lead to a downward spiral. The other is, how do we manage success? How do we manage the collective outcomes of individual success? When we do things as individuals, what's good for us is not always good for society. And the greatest challenge we have in this respect is that at 7 billion people in the world getting wealthier, at least 5 billion of them escaping a tragedy of the 2 billion who are disconnected from globalization. The challenge is an inclusive globalization to ensure they are connected. But as people move up, and 4 billion people in the world are moving up and escaping poverty, as they get wealthier, as they enjoy the successes of integration and the market economy, what they will do rationally, and as they get more and more individual choice, and we want that, we want people to have more freedom, more choice, these choices can lead to chaotic and collapsing outcomes. This tension between individual choice and collective failure is fundamental to the way that the world evolves. And there are many, many examples of it. Climate change is perhaps the biggest. It's rational for everyone to get a heater, get an air conditioner, get a car, eat processed food, get power, go up the chain from moving from $1,000 per capita to 20, maximizing your energy conversion at around $7,000 per capita. We know when everyone does that, the planet will burn. Average 4 to 5 or 6 degrees average increase in temperature. So how do we allow people to enjoy the privileges that we do of energy? We are where we are because we've been burning fossil fuels for at least 150 years with no price for carbon. Now we know the price. Another example of the lag between technological change and understanding of it. But it's too late. So what do we say to the rest of the world? Obviously we can't say stop burning. But how we manage this? And it requires real behavioral changes on our part. As we have more and more choice and more and more freedom, are we prepared to make them? And there are many, many other examples. You might have seen that a plate of sushi was sold for $10,000 in Tokyo recently. This rare tuna went for $1.8 million. Okay, one tuna. That's the market's response to the scarcity of a scarce resource. Inelastic. And the tuna don't know how much they're worth. They don't reproduce more. Nor do the rhinoceroses, and nor indeed do any natural resources. There's no more land when it's worth more, or water, or atmosphere. And so as we all exercise our individual choice and become wealthier and think that we can choose with our money what we want, we're not necessarily leading to a collectively stable outcome, and often not. Another example of this is antibiotic resistance, which is going to be a desperately important problem for all of us. It's rational for all of us to take our antibiotics and to give it to our loved ones. If we all do it, they will no longer be effective. And we see this in many, many new ways. So we won't be ready for the new pandemic because we're applying well over half our antibiotics as well to non-human uses, to animal feed, to make them more efficient, painting onto the hulls of ships so that the barnacles won't grow. And we don't believe in regulation because we want freedom. So this tension between how we manage collective outcomes and individual choice is absolutely central. It's not new. Economists have been thinking about it for hundreds and hundreds of years. In my town, Oxford, when it was a village, people used to put their cows on the meadow, Port Meadow. When a few of them did it, that was fine. As the village got wealthier and more people put their cows on the meadow, the meadow collapsed. And they had to have regulations, elders, to set rules about how often they could put their cows on, how many they could have. Unfortunately, we need that in many areas. As 7 billion of us exercise our choice, and how we do that, and what the role of the regulator, and whether it's just national or global, because of course it doesn't matter what we do in the UK if others don't do it too, in this hyper-connected world. And this tension between local and global grows. The world and everything we know about it is hyper-connected. Our governments and our systems are evolving at this fossilized national pace, where in many ways we're further back than we were 20 years ago in terms of what global institutions can do. They haven't kept pace. And we don't want them to keep pace. We're not empowering them. In fact, we're trying to pull back power. So this tension is one we need to think through. This is a wonderful school. And the ideas that foment here will be the ideas that drive the future. As you think about these issues, remember humanity's at the crossroads. This could be our best century ever, or it could be our worst. The choice is ours. Thank you.